can't hear us, just raise your hand. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to ULT in Philadelphia on this bright, sunny day. We'll begin the program by reading to you the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophy. Let it be known that the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy. Without professing attachment to any Theosophical organization, it is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissension or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or the inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among Theosophists wherever and however situated is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between the associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among Theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as Theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true Theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Anyone may pick up a copy of that declaration when they come in on the radiator and at the book table to find this wonderful little pamphlet, ULT. And there they'll find the declaration. And at the same time, they will find information as regards the program for each month, this being May the 3rd. And the topic for today, the Four Noble Truths. As you see, the doors opened this morning at 10:30, and we'll be done promptly at 11, and we'll be done by noon. On Wednesdays, the doors open at 5:15, so that you can come in and spend some time in our wonderful little library, and you will always find the librarian there to inform you as to what's available, including the topic for that particular Wednesday night. That meeting begins promptly at 7:15. And is over at
7:30.
Thank you very much. Now, on this little pamphlet, you will also find a list of the lodges around the world and other useful information as to how to go online and contact the United Lodge of Theosophy. Before we begin this morning's talk, we will have this announcement in reference to next week, which will be May 6th. We want to remind you and everyone else that this Wednesday we will pause in our weekly study in the Ocean of Theosophy by HPB to commemorate her life and work. The doors will open as usual at 5:15. In keeping with the solemnity of this moment, we invite everyone to come a little earlier and thus be better able to fix one's attention upon this yearly pause in gratitude that will be so expressed in the talks which will follow till 8:30 p.m. Now, as usual, we have a little reading before we begin the talk this morning, and it's from the Voice in the Silence. Please. This first disciple is the hall of sorrow wherein are set along the path of dire probation's traps to ensnare thy ego by the delusion called great heresy. This earth, O ignorant disciple, is but the dismal entrance leading to the twilight that precedes the valley of true light. That light which no wind can extinguish, that light which burns without a wick or fuel. Saith the great law, in order to become the knower of all self, thou hast first of self to be the knower. To reach the knowledge of that self, thou hast to give up self to non-self, being to non-being, and then thou canst repose between the wings of the great bird, aye, sweet as rest between the wings of that which is not born, nor dies, but is eternal throughout the ages. Bestride the bird of light, if thou wouldst know.
Thank you. Our topic this morning is the Four Noble Truths, and they come from Buddha. So what we thought was we'd give a little bit of his life as a primer for anyone who may not be familiar with it. And then we'd go into the particular ideas because they are practical and simple and short. And we can discuss how they apply to us. The story of the life of the Buddha is the story of our lives. There is that which we see and believe to be real and that which lies hidden just under the surface waiting to be discovered. It is the invitation to pull back the veil and peer inside as the Buddha did. His teachings point the way in which that life should be lived, and we are given practical teachings which show the path to wisdom. Born in 621 BCE, he achieved enlightenment and became a full Buddha, which is a title, in the year 592 and died in 543. There are many events recorded as happening within and surrounding the life of this man, but they are often allegory pointing to veiled truths, which are understood only by those who attained through merit initiation. So he is the son of a king, and the king wants very much to raise for the next generation the wisest and gentlest leader that he can. And he thinks the best way to do that is to surround this child with beauty wherever he looks. Music and flowers and trees with blossoms, anything that is pleasing to the eye, which would give him a heartfelt appreciation for nature. But as children will do as they grow, he becomes restless. Gautama becomes restless and wants to explore beyond the palace gates because that's all he can see. He's walled in above everything below. And he asks so often, the king finally says, fine, we'll go for a walk through the city, but pre-warns all the people, take the sick and the elderly and the those who are of a lower standing off the streets, clean the streets, place flowers where you can, as if to make another copy of what the prince sees every day. However, along the journey, the prince sees an old and infirmed man. He has never seen age before. He has never seen illness before and can't understand it. So this is the beginning of his pondering of the meaning of life and death, what might happen in the future, and he becomes more than ever determined to explore the outside world. However, the next step in the prince's life is the preordained dictate to be married and have children. And it is said there is a woman, when they place their eyes upon one another, they are sure they know each other from previous lives. So that is whom he takes for a wife. And after a period of familyhood and householdership, he explains to her that he feels the need to go out and be of service, the mission that he has, and she's trying to understand it, and this is what he says to her. This I will do because the woeful cry of life and all flesh living cometh up into my ears, and all my soul is full of pity for the sickness of this world, which I will heal, if healing may be found, by uttermost renouncing and strong strife. So his goal, and she sends him on the journey with her blessings. The goal of renouncing and being of service we're so familiar with in the Gita, detaching from things of this world, he goes out as a lowly one with just a bowl and offers to be of service and does not ask for anything, but if he is given food or money or anything to continue to keep his existence going in the bowl, he thanks them and uses it. So after much of this work for those in need and much meditation to understand all he has experienced, he becomes enlightened and now could feel the true self and its connection with all of life. So he thinks, this is it, I'm going to sit under this Bodhi tree and meditate on enlightenment, and that will help the world. However, we found a story about a Hindu Brahmin who crossed his path at this point and asked him what was next in his life. He could see that he had attained enlightenment. Buddha replied he would simply sit under the tree and meditate and send goodwill out into the world. The Brahmin, however, told him that there were those with just a little dust in their eyes. You love that phrase. Just a little dust in their eyes who could benefit greatly from what he had learned. Buddha then took to finding the disciples, or they were drawn to him, who could benefit by this knowledge, and he began to teach. This is said by some to be the first sermon Buddha gave after enlightenment. And we are told the ideas given in the Four Noble Truths are a lifetime's reflection for us. So the first is sorrow. Existence is suffering. Now we need to look at these in a universal way and a personal way. And that is how we will begin to understand the duality of our nature and how it affects all of these steps. So suffering is something we all share, from the plant who is burned, that is burned by the sun, to the animal that is used for food for the next higher kingdom, to any of us. We are attached to suffering because of the material nature of this age. Personally, we ask, why me? Or we blame our suffering on others. We don't understand it. From birth to old age to death, there is suffering in the body of different types. The experiences of a lifetime belong to us. If karma exists and cause leads to effect, how could anyone else be responsible for our thoughts, feelings, actions, and suffering? So the first step is to see that suffering is part of the nature of the universe. And the second half of that is to understand how it affects us. So the second noble truth is sorrow's cause. The origin of suffering is desire. Desire is a natural power of spirit. It's kama. It's a universal power. When used by us, it is colored and charged with our wants and our needs, of course. We are told that those wise ones said, to understand something, you need to stand under it. And we like that idea. Understanding desire means standing under it and looking at it dispassionately. We break the attachments we have created when we put some distance between our feelings and the truth and ponder them without passion. We are told to put all effort into development, no matter what the situation, because it is the only way we will recognize desire. The third noble truth is sorrow's ceasing. Suffering ceases when desire ceases. Makes perfect sense, right? We are told in the voice of the silence, kill out all desire of life, says Krishna to Arjuna. That desire lingers only in the body, the vehicle of the embodied self. Not in the self, capital letters, which is eternal, indestructible, which kills not, nor is it killed. So once we recognize our desires, we realize they are simply a reflection of the physical senses. We are told to recognize them, see that they are of a lower nature, and let them go. By that we mean leaving them as we found them. Our ultimate goal will be to concentrate on those desires of the higher self mentioned in the quote, but for now we must learn to recognize and let go. By not giving them feeling and motivation, we cause no harm and set no karma into motion. Again, from the voice, desire nothing, chafe not at karma nor at nature's changeless laws, but struggle only with the personal, the transitory, the evanescent, and the perishable. Now, the practical method of killing out or raising up desire also comes from the voice. Let the soul lend its ear to every cry of pain, like as the lotus bears its heart to drink the morning sun. Let not the fierce sun dry one tear of pain before thyself has wiped it from the sufferer's eye. but let each burning human tear drop on thy heart and there remain, nor ever brush it off until the pain that caused it is removed. These tears, O thou of most merciful, these are the streams that irrigate the fields of charity immortal. 'Tis on such soil that grows the midnight blossom of Buddha, more difficult to find, more rare to view than the flower of the Voge tree. It is the seed of freedom from rebirth. It isolates the arhat both from strife and lust. It leads him through the fields of being unto the peace and bliss known only in the land of silence and non-being. So we're told to kill out desire. The fourth noble truth is the way to do that. The end of desires is the eightfold path. In this path, to whatever place one would go, that place one's own self becomes. Thou art the path, is said to the adept guru, and by the latter to the disciple after initiation. I am the way and the path, says another master. Adeptship is the blossom of bodhisattva. So how do we achieve this task? We thought we would discover together the Eightfold Path, or if you have questions on anything so far. Yes?
Can you just run through the first four?
Yes. Life is suffering. The origin of suffering is desire. Suffering ceases when desire ceases, and the end of desires is the Eightfold Path, which is that practical method. Question?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we learn in Theosophy, though, that the suffering, these are what Mr. Judge calls opportunities for our advancement. So we wouldn't want to completely wipe out suffering then, would we? Or not?
It would seem that the only time we are dissatisfied is when we suffer. It is the opposite of the joy for another's accomplishment, or the being in nature for a couple of days and you're soaked with all that beauty. It's the suffering is usually very personal, and the great heresy that was in the reading is that separation, not realizing that everything around us is suffering also. We can stay in that suffering mode, but we're not going to move anywhere. We're not going to evolve. Yes?
It just dawned on us, could the relief of that suffering may not necessarily be the eradication of the suffering as much as our attitude towards the suffering?
Exactly. That's what it said, let it go. We recognize, the first step is to recognize the desire that's causing the suffering, to really truly stand under it, look at it apart from it. Oh, that's what it is. And leave it there, let it go, let the attachment to it that's causing your suffering, just as you said, let it be. And the more often we do that, the less we suffer, because we're not bound up in all those desires that is causing that. So that's exactly right. In the back there.
I was wondering about his biography. Was he born a Hindu? born, it seems as though it was a Hindu man. Was he born a Hindu? Was that his original belief system that he encountered?
We have to say we don't know for sure. It doesn't talk about that until later in his life, but he did come from and had his life in that area where those who were the enlightened ones, those who brought back these truths to us, existed. Any comments on that?
Yeah. Well, I lost your word, but he was part of the higher caste of India, the Brahmins, right?
Okay.
So he knew all the teachings, but he gave out that which he wasn't supposed to. All right, and but it was for the salvation of the world. You know, that suffering is from within outward. Root of our problem, we have built these shrines, these bodies that we worship, and what happens is that it develops a power, and that power is selfishness. So, you know.
Yes and no. I respect your answer to that. However, we think the phrase that the other Brahmin gave to him, there are those with just a little dust left in their eyes waiting for you. What could that mean?
In connection with this, this desire we're talking about, is it only the personal desire that we're speaking about? Because we're also thinking of its lower nature, that there is a higher desire within us too. So it's not all desire.
Right. So combining the last two thoughts, what the Brahmin said to him was, in essence, there are those who have learned to control their lower desires and now need what you have learned to reach where you are, which is the higher desires. We don't actually kill out desire. What we do is transmute it into something higher. And the way to that is in the Eightfold Path, which we can go into when we're ready. But that little bit of dust in the eyes was a reference to there were those waiting for these teachings. And they had reached a certain level but hadn't gotten that clarity yet that Buddha had attained. And it is said also he only gave the esoteric truths to those that he believed were worthy of it. Otherwise he would give sort of veiled truths and they would still have to work at it. Yes.
We read that actually Buddha was born a Hindu, and the intention was that he was going to be the reformer of Hinduism, but because of the static from the Brahmin caste, that reformation actually ended up being a movement or a philosophy or a religion in addition to Hinduism. So we have Buddhism. And then the tradition in Hinduism is actually that Buddha was reborn as Sankaracharya, and Sankaracharya
was the reformer.
Then reformed Hinduism from within.
Right. The reformer, though, he's born in the lifetime we're speaking about as a prince.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps that pulling away from the riches and the beauty and everything he was offered was the rising up of that feeling, I have to do, so I'm meant to do something else. And he was absolutely necessary at that time. We've never heard before that he gave things out that he wasn't supposed to. We will reference that and work on that. In the back, your question about higher desires. I did mention it is a natural universal spiritual power, the Kama, K-A-M-A, is part of everything, and it is actually what allows us to get up first thing in the morning and start a new cycle, and anything that we actually do is from that basis. What happens is when we call on it, we color it as to, I'm hungry, I don't like that person, I want more money, I need a better job, or as Buddha did, there are those who are suffering and I won't wipe the tear from my eye before I offer service to them so that they can be relieved from their suffering. So it depends on how it's used, but it is a universal power, yes. Did you have your hand up? No. Okay. Yes.
We often hear that the teachings of Buddha, the teachings of Christ are similar. Did you, in your studies, come across any examples of that?
Absolutely. The virtues that he expounded were brotherly love to all, kill no living thing, kindness to the lower kingdoms, to nature and animals, to give freely of what you have, not attached to it. He talked about the evolution of the universe and the golden rule, and that there was a natural truth underlying the teachings, and offered his students to check and verify that for themselves. So there are many, many similar teachings, and they were two very important souls in the Reformation movements at their time. Definitely. Yes.
The word suffering, and we heard a few quotes about it, is all suffering pain? Is all suffering pain?
Is all suffering pain? To the personal man, yes. To the immortal man, just another step in the direction of evolution, we would think. The pain, anything that is felt of a nature that it irritates the body, the mind, the feelings, is rooted, as it was said, in the body. That was a wonderful quote. Let me see if I can find it. Here it is. Kill out all desire of life, says Krishna to Arjuna. That desire lingers only in the body, the vehicle of the embodied self, not in the higher self, which is eternal, indestructible, cannot be killed. So the suffering that takes place is that which we allow to give us pain in the lower parts of our nature, particularly in our body. We've been privileged to sit in rooms where people are getting chemotherapy, and some are still smiling while others are getting sick and having a terrible time. So are they both suffering, and are they both suffering equally? It's often a matter of changing the thought, changing the feeling, recognizing that this is karma, and recognizing that I have the power to change it. Yes?
Well, it seems that it's very difficult for us in modern days to get over oneself. Suffer the little children to come. couldn't understand why that would necessarily be considered painful. So I think we have to do some thinking before we arrive at that point.
And we should remember that we're in the most material part of our development, most material age. The benefit of it is that we can move through it more quickly. But where we are right now, we're sort of attaching ourselves to everything of the material, which will eventually make you suffer because it is not real. It is not real. There was a hand in the corner. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
What we say about suffering and tutoring, I think that's just the difference between suffer as to tolerate, because I never understood what I do not suffer fools mean until somebody explained it to me. It means you put up with them, you tolerate them. So that makes sense. So to suffer the children to come unto you would be to tolerate it, to endure it. It wouldn't be to complain that it's painful to you and you don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
I
think tolerate's a very important word, and it goes back to the beginning question about how we think about suffering. Suffer the children, tolerate the children to come unto me. And it is a matter of anything that comes to us, can we tolerate it, or do we sink into it, or do we complain about it, or do we identify with it? I am ill. Rather than, I am experiencing an illness that I will recover from. So tolerate was a very good word for that situation. Yes?
Now, in studying Buddhism, we find many of the precepts and teachings are the same as theosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And I know from coming here that theosophists they aren't Buddhists.
Right.
What's the difference between Buddhism and theosophy?
Between Buddhism and theosophy, well, the first thing that comes to mind is that Buddhism is split into two schools, the northern and the southern, and they have different ideas on very important teachings. The one that comes to mind is reincarnation. We think it's the southern school that believes you can reincarnate back into a lower form, which wouldn't make any sense. If we're in evolution, why would we go backwards rather than forwards? And the difference between Buddhism and theosophy, for one thing, in theosophy, we don't worship or set out a god or a reformer or any particular personality as one we would worship. We're not asked to do that.
Buddhism has no idols before it. It's that Buddha nature, that Bodhi, and that's what they consider the god or that deific principle. It's very similar to theosophy.
Mm-hmm.
Just many, 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 many different writings explain these subtle metaphysical things that,
right,
you know, Buddhism has done. But we would think that what you said, that it's not an organized religion,
mm-hmm,
in that sense, and that you're not adhering to any association. You're independently,
mm-hmm,
devoted. And
absolutely,
that devotion is to those ancient teachings that Buddha put out.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're told, we never understood the phrase, don't throw pearls before swine. When it was mentioned that he perhaps gave some of these ideas to those who weren't ready for them yet. That's the same idea as throwing pearls before swine. They won't be recognized as having any worth. They don't mean anything to the one who's hearing them. You know, it's there's a sort of a protection, I guess, in a way, that those who can understand will grasp this and begin to change their lives. And those who are not ready will just hear it and go on. So in a sense, anyone who has walked into these rooms is at a point in their lives where they're looking for something. They know there's more, and they're listening to these ideas. Wait one moment.
Buddhism, or Buddha, expounded the heart doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
He did have the, he had a head doctrine, but it was the heart. It was, that's why he's called the Buddha of compassion.
That's the most important thing. Can you hold your question for one moment? In the Eightfold Path, there are eight items that are grouped into what we read from. Three groups, and the most important, where we are able to reach self-knowledge, is when the heart is pure. Because when the heart is pure, the mind is peaceful. So it is the highest, the heart doctrine is the highest teaching in a sense. Go ahead.
A couple things. The first, the bit about, you know, don't throw pearls before the swine. That teaching has to do with if someone's challenging you and is questioning, like if you have certain knowledge that they're being maybe sarcastic to, you know, really just back off and try to prove yourself. Because the other part of that statement is, and they will turn and rend you, turn on you and rend you.
Yeah.
So
never
the point
heard
is,
that.
You know, for people who think that they deserve something rather than sincerely inquiring about
right.
spiritual knowledge,
right.
if that's not the case, let it go, because it's not worth your time. But then also, with respect to Buddhism, I mean, the word, you know, Buddhism is huge. As it was said, there's the Hinayana, the Mahayana, and the difference. And some Buddhist sects are just flat out, absolutely esoteric, ritualistic,
mm-hmm.
priestly, believe that if they say the Buddha's name three times, they're going to be saved. So there's an entire range of understanding.
Absolutely.
Beliefs, as there is in Hinduism, what we call Hinduism in the West, really, I mean, there's hundreds of different sects and millions of different gods and everything, so.
Agreed, and what we would ponder is even those that we might think are on the wrong path or a lower path, are if these rituals and practices are being done with a pure heart, it is promising for the soul. Yes.
Sure. We're not. We're certainly not, you know, judging any of these different sects. It's just that you know, Buddhism to one person is not the same as it is to Buddhism to another person 8,000 miles away in a different culture.
Mm-hmm.
But if there are different sects, such as Hinduism, the value of having such truths in one's religion as reincarnation is simply, you know, an individual can stand back and say, well, in this sect, that's where they are right now. When they learn what they need to
mm-hmm.
learn, they're
exactly.
going to progress along this.
Yes.
But without the idea of reincarnation and karma, you're thinking, well, they're not doing it right, so they're going to go to hell and die. And that's the issue with the Western way of thinking.
That is the issue with the West. Thank you. Yes.
What was said can be said for any religion.
Sure.
Christian, you know, the religion does this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look at Jesus. You know, the rabbis hated him because he was teaching the secrets to the multitude,
mm-hmm.
and it all goes back to that same thing of sharing the knowledge with the world to set them free. You know, ideas set you free. You know, we think that fight and suppress, those that are different than us. No. We have to become free.
Exactly. So let's look at the Eightfold Path, which the end of which is that freedom. And it's not linear, although it's presented that way as a natural way for development. So the first two ideas are right belief and right thought. And they fall under the category of wisdom. And this is where, have we taken the time to root out the old ideas that we carried for years, that we've already proved to ourselves are not the truth? Have we thought and investigated the beginning of the day and the end of the day, what we did and what the results were? So that's wisdom. That's the first step. That's the knowledge. The next three are encapsulated as morality in everything we do. Think about that. The third of the Eightfold Path is right speech. The fourth is right conduct or action. And the fifth is right livelihood or occupation, which we think might be difficult in today's world. We may have a tremendous longing, desire to do a certain thing in life, and for whatever / karmic reasons, we are not able to do that. Well, morality in everything we do, whatever livelihood we have, we do it to the very best we can, morally and ethically. So right speech, so important, right conduct and right livelihood. The last three, it is said, lead to this freedom. And they are encapsulated under concentration. Number six is right effort or exertion, knowing when to act and acting from the highest. Seven is right contemplation. Doing that from the highest in the most sacred way, being willing to look at what we've done wrong, standing under it, apart from it, and being willing to change it. And the last one is right concentration, leading to ecstasy. So that would be our meditation practices and our deep, deep thoughts about how we are acting, how we are speaking, what we believe, how we are working, all of those things. And it says, when the heart is pure, the mind is peaceful, and this is the path to ecstasy. So that is the Eightfold Path. And we can do a little bit of that every day. Right belief and right thought, that's why we're here. We're working that out here. Right speech, that's a tough one. It's that phrase of holding your tongue when you want to say the wrong thing or the mean thing or the depraving thing. We don't. Instead, we use right speech, and we know how important that is. Your hand was up. Yes.
We recall recently in the library on the table, please note, in the library on the table was a beautiful picture of the Buddha. That picture, when we look at it, we don't need an explanation.
Mm-hmm.
It speaks
so peaceful.
Itself.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing, in the declaration, it says, by study or otherwise,
mm-hmm.
that we can hear these wonderful words and so forth. But the thing that's offered is the opportunity to independently investigate these ideas.
Yep.
And that picture still has a hold can't remember any other library or any other experience where we were so impressed by that symbol.
Right.
Felicitation.
Absolutely. And we recently were walking down a block and there was a young man. Actually, we were standing waiting to get in somewhere, and there was a young man a couple of doors up with a cardboard with writing on it. We couldn't see it. We just knew he had something. And instead of a bowl, he had a plastic cup. And we were speaking with our partner in this endeavor, and we said, that could be a Buddha. This could be the last lifetime. He's making obeisance to being quiet, to not pestering, to not judging nor being judged. And more people stopped. Someone gave him breakfast and someone else gave him a dollar. And we saw more activity because he was quietly sitting, holding the sign, and had the cup there. And it reminded us of the Buddha in, you know, rags with the bowl. Yes.
And the teaching, study or otherwise, we call this sentence, nirvana on both sides of death. And we don't, the word nirvana, everybody uses the word, but you have no idea. But at least it must be something that Buddha has experienced. And the idea that
bliss.
We can experience that on both sides of death.
Mm-hmm.
We still have to go back to that declaration in order to begin our work, because words can have no meaning unless we understand the heart of the issue.
Yes. We have to really learn and concentrate on those phrases like being and non-being and the self to the higher self to the lower self. It's all puzzling in the beginning, but the more you look at it and the more you ponder it and the more you look for references on it, it begins to dawn and awaken within you, and then you are able to see more clearly. It's a step on that path. Yes.
In terms of right livelihood,
mm-hmm.
you know, we've all thought about it. Are we doing the right thing? Do we have the right livelihood? And the only thing that comes out of that consideration is that in these teachings, the universal brotherhood is a fact of nature. So our livelihood has to be to serve, to help,
yes.
to be of service. And so whatever job we have, whatever, there's always other people involved. So
right.
that giving
yes.
is the right livelihood. It
Absolutely.
Doesn't matter what you're doing. It's the attitude of your heart and your mind.
Absolutely. And we had the privilege of seeing both sides of that. We worked in a family business for 25 or 30 years, and then it was taken over. And the one who bought it was impossible to work for. Impossible. So much so that he made me sick and I had to leave. So the difference being, one was always concentrating on his people and making sure everyone had enough and spreading the work around. And one was concentrating simply on dollar bills. And the experience of both is a treasure, because we know now, if we were ever in that position, how we would want to act. So it's very important. We agree with you. Yes?
You said what I was going to say.
Oh, wise man. Any other thoughts? Well? Yes.
Well, we think in Buddhism, a lot is spoken of concentration
mm-hmm.
and meditation. And it's really like one of the avenues understanding that, or not understanding, but becoming aware of that unchanging essence that we are, you know, that witness to our life. And by concentration and meditation upon that, we become one with it.
Absolutely. And then desire is used in its correct way. And we just lost our thought. I'm sorry, we lost our thought. Yes.
The recent disaster in Nepal, mm-hmm. which is a Buddhist country, has caused some people to think, or to say even, that if, because people believe, Buddhists believe in karma, perhaps it's their karma to suffer this great disaster, not understanding what it means. It's not their karma, it's all of our karma.
Yes.
Because if you stand by on the sidelines and you don't help, you have created your own karma.
Absolutely.
But it's interesting because they had a whole, about a 15-minute talk on that particular subject on NPR last week.
Right, and the one thing we are told in every avenue of Buddhist teachings and theosophy and some of the other religions is not to judge. We are not in a position to say, that's your karma, you have to deal with that. We are in a position to say, what a tragedy, how can I help? It's a completely different state of mind, of desire, of feeling, of thought. So when we act to the very highest we can, we honor those wise ones. And we just have time for a short reading from the Voice of the Silence. And this, we think, we can start every day and hopefully achieve in this lifetime. Be humble if thou wouldst attain to wisdom. Be humbler still when wisdom thou hast mastered. Be like the ocean which receives all streams and rivers. The ocean's mighty calm remains unmoved. It feels them not. Restrained by the divine, the lower self. Restrained by the eternal, the divine. I, great is he who is the slayer of desire. Still greater he in whom the self divine has slain the very knowledge of desire. Guard thou the lower, lest it soil the higher. We will see you Wednesday for White Lotus Day, honoring H.P. Blavatsky. Again, the meeting, we'd like everyone to come in a few minutes early and get seated and start with the right attitude in the room. So the meeting is at 7:30. You're welcome in any time before that. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.